Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 99, section 4, which is old single column, page 1089. So here we are in the midst of the first these five papers on the nature of religion. Remember last session we were starting to build up some significant substance that we were being challenged to consider. It's a challenge because real religion is so different than what humans have always conceived it to be. Religion, that is. I'll just remind you again, just because I can't emphasize it enough times for you to all to always sort of have that little thumbnail sketch of real religion in the back of your mind that they introduced there in that list towards the end of section 3, item number 3, creative, comforting, and then the part, you know, to just kind of keep in mind, love expanding fellowships. That the degree to which you go beyond religion in its pure sense, where it's purely individual, purely inner life, and you have some group phenomenon, right? I mean, what's one of the ways that you can, what's one of the points that you can reflect on and to understand the way in which that group phenomenon is bounded away from groups that are social, political, and or economic in nature, right? And just that simple, challenging little statement of describing them not as service-expanding fellowships, but as love-expanding fellowships. And, you know, the sort of giant mystery that then opens up before you of what exactly that looks like. Right? It's very hard for us to, you know, to think about how you organize a group when it's not fundamentally geared towards some external world accomplishment. You know, but instead is an inner world accomplishment-oriented group.
Yeah. My wife, years ago, when we first joined the church, and she went to church in those days, so they had a women's group that she joined, and they called it Serendipity because it was didn't really have a purpose in mind except to get together or to socialize,
mm-hmm.
and to get to know one another and share ideas or whatever. But then someone came, determined, well, they need to have a mission.
Mm-hmm.
They need to do something to justify
their existence. So,
anyway, she said, that spoiled it for her.
Right.
It was never the same after that.
Right. And, you know, she was looking for something that was very just place-like and to make it some, you know, directed arrow phenomenon, you know, spoiled it. You know, you had some comment too?
Well, you know, love expanding fellowships really to me is service. I mean, I don't see how you separate love from service because, you know, loving means you need somebody else. You can't just, it's not just you alone. You can't just love yourself, so to speak. So when you express yourself, I mean, the whole path of our whole career throughout the entire universe is going to be service, more service, hard service, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, they talk about it. It's the, what do they say, the goal of time and the destiny of space or whatever. And so if that's grounded in love as the reason, you know, why do you serve? You know, if that's the main thing. I look at love as being the Father, mercy as being the Son, and service as being the infinite Spirit, but in terms of ministry. So I look at those two together. So I don't hope you're not saying that you can't have real religion without loving service.
Well, again, the whole point is not to somehow separate service from love. Right? You know, all the revelators are saying is it would be helpful to society because a society needs an improved level of service, and as long as love and service in terms of organizations are very tightly tied, it's impossible to develop either of them to the degree that they can potentially be developed. By separating them and then subsequently bringing the fruits of those together, you'll get more than what you get when they're just naturally together. It's the super additive consequence thing. You know, why is there more than one being in the universe? You know, why couldn't you just satisfy beingness by having one infinite being? Right? It would, that being would fill all of everything. I mean, you know, what would you be missing? Right? You're missing all potential for any super additivity. So the challenge is, you know, in reading these papers, is to not dismiss service, but just for the moment to set it aside and say, we're not going to talk about service immediately here. You know, we're going to just focus on the inner life predicate for a while, and when we have greater fruits of that effort to achieve a greater inner life, then we're going to subsequently think about service, so that service has an energy behind it that it never had before, because, you know, when service is right there, there's a tendency to kind of take the inner life, the love, for granted. It's like, well, okay, we got love, now let's serve. Yeah, by grace, we all have the beginnings of love, but if we took delight in cultivating, we could have more love, we could have more personal realization of divine fellowship. And if we had more love, the service would have a higher quality. So, you know, that's what they're saying is, and you know, we'll see as we get into this, you know, this is all involved in the next section, the transition difficulties. There's a lot of difficulties in this transition. You can't just separate the two of them.
Focusing on religion versus focusing on other things, that what most religions do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're all about this drive or that drive or this political or whatever.
Right.
I understand that point,
right,
in terms of focusing on religion, which they, you know, you go to services and they don't really focus on a lot of religion. You know, they maybe do a little bit of something, but whatever it is, it certainly doesn't get into the whole aspect of encouraging people to believe and understand that they are a son or daughter of God. I mean, and that there's, especially not the religion that we've learned from here.
Yeah, so all they're saying is, you know, you can't, it's not like you can somehow magically snap your fingers and not have some institution called religion. But, you know, and you can't make that religion somehow completely pure, you know. I mean, it obviously, you know, as we're going to read here, it's going to have relationship to others, you know, inescapably as part of it. I mean, none of us are literally an island universe, even if we try to make ourselves one. But they're saying, just redouble your efforts to consciously make it a little bit more separate than it used to be. And 100 years from now, a little bit more separate than it used to be still. And 100 years after that, a little more separate, right, than it used to be even more so. Right? So that more and more you can move to having a very different kind of a group on a planet, where it's not classifiable with all the other flavors of groups. It stands apart as a special kind of a group that in and of itself is dedicated to producing significant individuals, not producing a significant group phenomenon, but producing significant individuals who then go out as the nuclei of improved group phenomena. Right? We'll see that's the future of religious groups, to serve in that role. See, not unlike what we talk about all the time with the third epical revelation with Machiavelli and Melchizedek, right? Where you create a parallel stream to the main evolutionary stream, right? He's ministering to Abraham and giving a booster shot to the main evolutionary stream, but also in secret in many ways, right? Not overtly, he's fostering the Kenites and those like him in a parallel stream, which will produce leaders occasionally, nuclei, that go into that main evolutionary stream. Just as a relator like Machiavelli is doing that in the macroscopic humanity, in the collective, we want to do this in the more microscopic, if you will, a microcosm of that, where you've got your outer life of service in some group setting, but as a parallel stream to that, you have an inner life. And that inner life is what provides a nucleus, a leadership nucleus, for your outer life in that group setting. So, and just institutionalizing that. I mean, obviously, any individual could just do it without any institution. But more and more, as civilization advances, to institutionalize that process, where there's an institution that's dedicated to that parallel stream, if you will. The love stream that's parallel to the service stream. The inner life stream that's parallel to the outer life stream. Yeah, they're not going to be isolated from one another. They're going to be an intimate interplay. But they're fundamentally dedicated in their immediacy, to very different goals.
Was that why they start the thing off by early Christianity was entirely free? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's similar to what you're saying. In a
right,
way.
Right. See, they were saying...
It started out, right? They just kind of got off.
Yeah, of it. The early Christianity started out like it because Jesus tried to start that. Okay. And they're saying it didn't last very long. You need to remind yourself of what Jesus tried to start. He was trying to start that... initially in individuals, what I was just describing, and then that would go forward and get kind of institutionalized into the society, where there's a whole special group phenomenon of the society that's just dedicated to establishing those nuclei. You see, they're fundamentally faith nuclei, right? That are embedded in individuals as nuclei. And those individuals, having been... activated like that by their religious group, then go out and act. But act with a cosmic predicate now, instead of the natural one that just is, let's absorb the outer, the external world into an individual and then he regurgitates it. See, I mean, you can't progress right? See, it doesn't go anywhere if the leaders are just an internalization of what's out there already. You know, somehow you've got to have leaders that are original in their social context. And the only source of that is above. You have to bring that down from above into the individual. You can't absorb it in from what's all around you. Right? It's the same old, same old. You just do that. Right? So that's what they're trying to get us to recognize, that that's the future you can start to move toward. And as you see, they'll talk some about how it can be a group phenomenon, this sort of future religious institution. I mean, if, like I said, I mean, if religion is, you know, in its pure sense is purely individual, okay, I mean, there's no group thing possible, okay? So there must be some measure of bringing it down a little bit from purely your individual relationship to the Father, right? And how do you bound that? How do you bring it down a little bit, but not so much that it then just morphs into like a social organization, right? So let's look for that as we get into this here. So let's see if we can figure out how to start to think about navigating, as they're saying, these difficulties here.
Section 4, transition difficulties. Genuine religion renders the religionist socially fragrant and creates insights into human fellowship. But the formalization of religious groups many times destroys the very values for the promotion of which the group was organized. Human friendship and divine religion are mutual, helpful, and significantly illuminating if the growth in each is equalized and harmonized. Religion puts new meaning into all group associations, families, schools, and clubs. It imparts new values to play and exalts all true humor.
Okay, those last two sentences is what I was just describing, with that nucleus, see, that goes out puts new meaning and imparts new values, etc. Okay, so we've already fleshed that out. Okay, but look at the rest of the paragraph there. So it starts out: genuine religion renders the religionist socially fragrant. So, if you have a genuine religionist, you don't have to be concerned that there's not going to be a social consequence. There is going to be service. It's inescapable. Okay? It creates new insights into human fellowship. See, there's where you're starting to get that originality. So you're thinking about ways to foster, to catalyze human fellowship that has never been there before. We've got to come up with incredibly unimaginable new ways. Otherwise, how are we going to advance all the way to light and life? And we've got so much advancing to do. It's going to require so many new ways of socializing, that we've never even remotely tried. If we do everything that we've done in the last million years, we'll be where we are right now. Right? So everything that you can think of for socializing gets you to where you are right now. It doesn't progress us one iota. Right? So, that's the silly thing that so many people, they get all excited. It's like, oh, we're going to be this socially fragrant group. We've got all this energy. We're going to go out. See, but, they don't lead to any actual progress because all they do is what's been done for the last million years, which that just makes sure that you don't lose, at least you won't lose what the last million years has achieved, but you won't progress anything. It won't take one single step forward. Infinite numbers of first milers just maintain first miler status on the planet.
Here's the talents I gave you.
Right. It's a simple physics, right? That if it's going to actually progress, you have to do something that no one's ever done before, not just do what something someone has done before with supposedly more energy than anyone has ever done it with before, right? I mean, you're kidding yourself if you think somehow you're more energetic than everyone that's ever lived. This is not the case, right? There's been some really energetic people, Okay? Really smart, really energetic, you know, 100 times more than anything you are. Right? They've been there, done that. It got us to where we are right now. How do we get farther than we are right now?
Yeah, they say in the Christianity thing about you can't get there by the old medieval drumbeat, so to speak. You've got to come forward from where you are in something new. And
yeah.
So what is that?
What is that, see? Yeah. See, and the only source of such unimaginable originality is within us, you know, is that inner domain where originality exists only. Right? I mean, there is no real inner originality anywhere except in the inner life. Only the inner life is creative. The lower domain that you know you basically use as a first miler, it can be very, very clever, you know, in complexifying the old forms. But see, like I said, you're not going to be more clever than the most clever person's ever lived. I mean, someone has already complexified it as much as it can be complexified. Right? It's not going to get us anywhere that we haven't already gotten. If we've lost ground, maybe it can kind of get us back to, you know, where we were, you know, 100 years ago or something. Okay, there's that. But see, if you really are interested in going where no man has gone before, cleverness is not going to do it. You're going to need originality. Something distinctly independent of anything that anyone has ever done or thought.
Chris?
Yep.
But I think it will be built upon some of those social ways that we do get together, for instance.
Sure.
But it will be in a creative, new, more lifelike way.
Yeah.
But we still have to have that foundation, or else it will really be different, like we'll be from another planet or something.
Yeah, right. So it's not like somehow we, you're gonna do it, in some completely different sort of technical way. I mean, everyone in light and life, they're still jiggling air molecules to talk. Okay, I mean, it's not like somehow you're doing something different than that. Right? So the basic technical means are there, but you're just going to use them in towards ends that they've never been used before.
Something. Well, they said, I read the other paragraph before this section. Mm-hmm. Creative and comforting. To me, that's key. To be creative with it makes it different.
Yeah.
And you can't imagine it ahead of time almost, too.
Exactly. And just be open to how wonderful it's, bringing the cosmos in, and having that creativity happen. I mean, that's what makes it delightful, is it's not imaginable. You just open yourself up to it and delight in what happens. Mm-hmm. Right? So they go on there. See, again, what I was saying, way up front. See, but the formalization of religious groups many times destroys the very values for the promotion of which the group was organized. Like I said, that's the tricky part. It's so easy for material gravity to pull a religious group down and out too far, where you lose sight of, the inner inspiration that was the organizing principle, right? And it just ends up in the same old mode.
Is that like Mother Teresa of Calcutta?
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, any group just has this tendency to kind of, you get the Urantia book and you get this, uplifted perspective churning in your mind. And then you get together in a group kind of predicated on this inspiration, and as the years roll by, you find yourself kind of slipping down and out of the book and kind of looking to, there's that group over there, led by Bob, and Bob is, very successful. Why don't we do what Bob is doing, right? See, that you just invariably are just going to regurgitate, you start thinking of regurgitating what's someone else has done or someone else is doing. Right?
And does it deplete you out
Yeah. Okay, and so look at, they're giving us some clues, not just telling us this is difficult. Human friendship. Human friendship and divine religion are mutually helpful and significantly illuminating, etc. Okay. This is a point that's important no matter where you are in the book. You need to recognize that the word friend in the book is not being used in the flippant way that humans use it. It's being used in the way it literally, etymologically, is supposed to be used. You know, like when they say that, you know, after years of being with the apostles, Jesus would finally call them friends. Right? You know, we get a cold call from some guy on the phone and he says, "Hi, friend." Right? Kind of the opposite. Right? Why is there this difference? Because the word friend, the root word there is love. Okay. So see that human friendship, okay, where you're talking about love, okay, sixth level of meaning. Love is the predicate. And divine religion, right? Personal realization of divine fellowship, that love on the sixth level of meaning, right? The religious level, right? Those two things are on the predicates for those two facts, human friendship and divine religion, are the same level, the sixth level, right? The level at which you begin to bring the cosmos into the upper domain, the cosmic foundation of your mind. Right? If you start with that common predicate, whether you're talking about you as an individual with divine religion, or your immediate relationship to the others in the group, right? You're not relating to those others in the group based upon mutual need for service. You're based on those others in the group, as the word friendship says. It's about the love predicate that you share, the sixth level that you share. Okay. See, and so you have the individual and the interplay between individuals that you're going to bring together. Now, as they're saying there, you have them on equal footing. Right, as the growth in each is equalized and then harmonized. So you get all the super additive consequence, super summative consequence, you know, of the collection of individuals in the group. So that's your first little hint about where this goes. You know, and in the same way that they emphasize divine ahead of the word religion, they emphasize human in front of the word friendship. To remind you that a fancy animal can't have a friend, technically. Right? Only a human can have a friend. Right? You know, and likewise, an animal can't be your friend.
Don't tell that to most of them.
Don't tell that to, yeah, of course. But see, that's what we're trying to get at. Right? And see, friendship, I mean, for a long time, Jesus called his apostles' brethren, right? He was acknowledging the interplay amongst them on the level of kindness, the level of kin-likeness, brotherly love. But eventually he was willing to say they had a common predicate two levels up from the fourth level, right? They were friends. They started with genuine love. Not merely kindness. Okay, got a couple. Yeah, you're first.
Sam used the word equalized.
Mm-hmm.
When they're talking about divine religion and human friendship, so are they, we're talking about the spiritual realm?
The Equalize is, you aren't just this island universe individual. You're equally, are engaged, identified out there with your fellow. Right? So that, you're starting with, see, if you're going to bring the two together in a super additive consequence, they have to be equals in their basic essence. Right? It can't be all about you. It can't be all about them. Right? This needs to be equalized. And then there's a real super additive consequence there. If you're going to get the super additive consequence between science and religion, right, science and religion have to be on equal footing. Right? One can't be greater and the other lesser in any way. I mean, if you're going to get that super additive consequence of genuine philosophy, right, those two have to be, on the same level, right, so that they meet. Same basic quality and quantity, right, so they meet.
I didn't know that, so the super additive consequences of consequence of religion and science is philosophy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Genuine philosophy.
Genuine philosophy.
Yeah, not what's been called philosophy a lot. So you can see in just that first paragraph, they're reminding you of this problem, the difficulty that material gravity is always wanting to degrade the religious group, getting it too down and out as a group. And it's like, well, how can I keep spiritual gravity enough in play so that that doesn't happen? I can't turn off material gravity. I've got to balance it with an equal amount of spiritual gravity. How do I do that? Well, as an individual, I do that by making sure I stay firmly grounded on the sixth level of meaning inside. Right? I'm starting with eternity inside and working out to time. And I don't flip my feet down to time. I keep my feet planted in eternity as the predicate. And in my relationship with others, I start the same way. I don't start, with their gout. I start with their spiritual consciousness. I start with their religious consciousness. I start with them top down too and not bottom up. I keep myself top down and I start with them top down. So then, within me and between us, there's spiritual gravity in play that will keep it, will balance out the material gravity. But the moment I look to you as someone who needs to be fed first, right, and not starting with, you as a friend, a sixth level person in common with me, I mean, if I start with the sixth level of meaning, it doesn't matter if I'm hungry or full or you're hungry or full. I mean, that's not the first thing that I'm considering. But if the first thing I consider about you is some physical thing, see, I'm just, I'm going to be down and out, and this is a social thing now. So that's the key. And it all relies in not letting the word friend be degraded like humans always want to degrade it, just like they degrade the word happiness, right? And so dogs are friends and dogs are happy, and it's like, no, those are human words. They have absolutely nothing to do with animals. Not to say that animals aren't cool.
We're so mean.
But they're not humans.
Nobody unfriended anybody. Right? They weren't friends.
Yeah. Right, you just how flippantly we use friend, right, in social media. It's really problematic, right? You got to go back. I mean, it's the place in the book that, like I said, that should first get you thinking, wait a minute, I don't think they're using the word friend like I use it, is when they tell you that Jesus finally was calling them friends. It's like, what? Right, that should just, it's like, okay, stop everything. Let me get the dictionary out. What's the root meaning of the word friend? Oh, my goodness. It's love. That's what the word means. It means, you know, a friend is a lover. Literally, you know, that's the word. The word literally means lover. Right? Now, can you interpret that on something besides the first level of meaning, as a sex partner? It's like, no, it's not what it means. Right? Yeah, do you have some?
I do.
Yep.
To me, this what it brought up was at the end of paper two. You know, the religious challenge, which I'm sure you know mm-hmm. that quote almost by mm-hmm. heart. You know, of this age is to those far-seeing and forward-looking men and women of spiritual insight who will dare to construct a new and appealing philosophy of living out of the enlarged and exquisitely integrated modern concepts of cosmic truth, universe beauty, divine goodness. Such a new and righteous vision of morality will attract all that is good in the mind of man and challenge that which is the best in the human soul. Truth, beauty, and goodness are divine realities, and as man's ascends the scale of spiritual living, these supreme qualities of the eternal become increasingly coordinated and unified in God who is love. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of, you know, that particular paragraph goes along, I think, a lot with what we're talking about here. It sort of reflects, I mean, I read that, I said, okay, boy, if we can figure that one out, then we can, the religious challenge, we could, you know, start this religious challenge and make it happen, you know. And then when you get into these papers on religion, what you're saying sort of, to me, brings that out a little bit more and really hits to the whole. You just said something a minute ago, which is basically, and what I heard anyway, is that when you interact with someone at the spirit level or at, you know, the heart level,
start at the top.
That sinks in, whether you think it does or not, because it sinks into the spirit level in that particular person. And we don't always realize how real that is, because it may not have, you know, material or conversational repercussions immediately. But I think it definitely does things over time.
Just try that out. Try starting at the top of a person first. Right? Starting at their boundary to the cosmos first, inside, and work your way down to their hangnails. Okay? Don't start with the hangnails.
It takes practice.
It takes practice because it's not natural. See, it's natural to start with what you see, right? Or what you hear. I hear your tummy growling, right? I see that you're dirty, you know, whatever.
I don't have any spirit change.
Right?
That ties to...
you got something?
...with Winston's here. He's struggling with... Does this friendship or group equalized in gravity, just as a wife and husband ground on the sixth level too?
Of course. See, I mean, you know, when you talk about, you know, having, you know, true monogamy is one of the indispensables, right? I mean, that true relationship, you know, the only way to get to a true relationship is to start with it being foundationally a real relationship. In other words, a relationship that starts with your common foothold in eternity and then goes from there. Right? If it starts with time, it's an actual relationship, but it's not a real relationship. And it can never be a true one then. Right? The only way is if you start with reality, if you start inside at the top.
Even if the other person doesn't realize it.
Even if the person doesn't realize it, yeah. And the more the other person is doing the same way, see, the more incredible the consequences, of course. Mm-hmm. Right? But imagine what a planet would be like if everyone was that way. See, again, that's... Right, see, why you can't imagine a normal world in the post-Bestolzon age.
People look at having things in common like the same food, or the, you know, the same movies, or the same books.
Yeah. I mean, think of a billion people on a planet, you know, where everyone is starting in common with eternity, you know, in a synchronization with the cosmos. Think of the super summative consequence of a billion real people. Right? Super additive. Between two objects is almost incomprehensible. right? Can't figure out how hydrogen and oxygen can make a water molecule. I mean, what happens if you have a billion unique things in a collective supersummative consequence? What on earth does that produce? It's incomprehensible.
Right? A little second mile action.
All right.
Social leadership is transformed by spiritual insight. Religion prevents all collective movements from losing sight of their true objectives. Together with children, religion is the great unifier of family life, provided it is a living and growing faith. Family life cannot be had without children. It can be lived without religion, but such a handicap enormously multiplies the difficulties of this intimate human association. During the early decades of the 20th century, family life, next to personal religious experience, suffers most from the decadence consequent upon the transition from old religious loyalties to the emerging new meanings and values.
Hmm. Curiously, we were just talking about, right, relationship between man and woman and, you know, as a foundation of a family. Right, and so just exactly what I was just saying. You know, why is it, are the difficulties enormously multiplied? Right? If you try to start with some commonality in time, that's a pretty tenuous and limited thing. Fleeting at best, usually. If you start with eternity, nothing fleeting about it, right? It's an immutable common foundation. And everything then can build from there. Right? It's enormously beneficial to the relationship if each one starts with eternity within themselves and then comes together with that in common.
So is that your true objective?
You know, rather than, the only thing we have in common is we like to hike. Like, as far as that going to take you?
Up and down the river.
And then when the one person has an accident and is crippled, then what?
Look at pictures of the river.
not that hiking isn't wonderful, right? It's just, again, as they're pointing out, as they say, it can be lived without religion, but it can't be really lived. Just merely lived, right? It's not a, when they say living and growing, they mean really living, right? Not merely living. Well, the guy and the gal are both breathing. No, that's not what we're talking about. So again, when you say really, it means you're starting with eternity. And then they point out, right, as you move into the 20th century with the Enlightenment, family life next to personal religious experience suffers most, right, from this decay. Because you needed to move out of those old religious loyalties that had, but see, you got to remember, there's more there than meets the eye. There was consciously those old religious loyalties were very superstitious and simplistic and whatnot. But super consciously, there was a reality there. There was some spiritual gravity. So when you throw the baby out with the bathwater, right, you lose the spiritual gravity. And so it's this very difficult transition problem. That if you're going to, the sort of immediate overt things that need to be improved, you got to make sure that you don't let go inside. It's like, but the problem is you didn't know that you were holding on inside, because it wasn't a conscious part of the phenomenon. All the ritual and whatnot was the conscious part of the phenomenon. So you have to step one, you got to recognize that before you let go, I'm unbeknownst to me, I'm holding on inside. So as I go forward and improve the external phenomena, I need to now consciously hold on inside. So I don't lose that spiritual gravity, so that everything doesn't decay, doesn't fall down. And the interesting thing about them using decadence is there's the immediacy of what they're saying there is just that it's literally going down, decaying. Okay, but we all know that word decadence kind of comes back around to the mode we're in now, where you have this cultural decadence. See, when you don't have that unrecognized spiritual gravity inside, you will be desperately trying to make up for it in your outer life with an ever more decadent society, right? That gets more and more focused on me and how everything about me needs to be fancy and wonderful and exciting, and and it just becomes this, it's the fall of Rome stuff, right? Yeah, so they very purposely used that word decadence to remind you of that subsequent phenomenon that we see very much now, that you didn't see back at the beginning of the 20th century. But you definitely see now. I mean, the cultural decadence now is just, ridiculous.
I don't quite gather the emerging new meanings and values. Where's that coming from? We're losing our grip on religion.
Yeah. We'll see. I mean, it doesn't come, but like I said, there. You can make this transition to emerging new meanings and values. But like I said, you've got to do that consciously now. It's not, the initial meanings and values are what you have by grace unconsciously, and that's what's been carrying mankind forward for the last million years. If you're going to progress, you need new meanings and values. You need more inside, like I was saying, than what's ever been inside. And to have more, it has to be a conscious possession now. Okay. Right? I mean, everyone is given a maximized unconscious possession by grace. It's just, you can't get any more out of that. Right? You can't progress civilization unwittingly, in spite of ourselves, anymore.
Just tie in with the sheltered bay where the shelter was... Those two work together.
Yeah, obviously.
To progress you.
Yeah.
But now that the shelter's gone, you got to step up with the internal conscious.
Yeah, I mean, not only do you need a greater internal in order to progress, but coincidentally, the outer life will be more demanding. The whole immediacy of the sheltered bay, high seas analogy. Guess what? This is going to be required. Not only do you need it to progress, but you need it to not drown. See, and it's like, well, why is it twofold like that? Because the more you go forward, the more dynamic it is. Right? And the more double-edged the sword gets. It's just more and more... when you get into a very advanced state, the instant that everyone isn't precisely choosing, there's literal pandemonium. Right? I mean, if the Universal Father isn't infinitely perfectly choosing every nanosecond, there's instant universal pandemonium. See, and you're moving towards being godlike, being in that same state where, everything is held together because all the individuals are choosing thus. And the instant they don't choose, it doesn't just get a little bit more difficult, it completely blows up, right? In utter catastrophe. Hey, that's what it's like to be in a world in the age of light and life. We think in simplistic bliss terms about light and life. Oh, you get there and everyone can just lay there like blobs, you know, and it all just happens magically. No, it's the exact opposite. Right? I mean, it's like in order to get into Havona, right, you have to have perfection of purpose. Right? Your purposing can't be off by one micro degree. Because if they let you in and your purposing wasn't spot on perfect, it was off by a minuscule degree, you would blow up the entire central universe. It'd just be universal pandemonium. It's that precise a place.
You won't get past Havona World Number 40, though.
Right? See, and it's just hard for us to imagine something. It's like, you know, that sounds really fragile. Yeah, from a static perspective, it is. But see, that's why we're so used to thinking of stability in static terms. No, you got to think of dynamic terms, ever greater dynamic terms, where things stay just so because of the precision of choice, not because it just lays that way.
Would you always say the universe is mind-managed?
Mind-made and personality-managed. Right.
Mind what, did you say?
Mind-made
right,
and personality-managed. Yeah.
Which is basically what you're just saying.
That's exactly what I'm saying, right? We forget that because we're in a grace bubble where it appears that everything kind of just happens, you know, and no one even has to think about it. That's an illusion. And it's not really so. Nothing just happens, right? Everything that is chosen thus.
We'll never do away with national borders until we have those borders internalized.
Yeah, yeah. All these things that you can think about civilization like that, you know, go in hand in hand with it. Yeah. So, and all of this, we're trying to think about this getting started for the first time in this planet. The potential to get to such an unimaginable state of affairs in the world, you know, an economy for the world that's like the economy of Havona, right? Yeah. There's such intense, precise laws of the house like that, right? But to begin the journey towards that unimaginable destiny, we have to have individuals with real conscious inner lives. And it would be very helpful if we began to have an institution that was dedicated just to that task. All right. Because we all can kind of use, the reinforcement of mutual edification, right? Reminders and assistance and keeping that spiritual gravity in play. All right. Let's see, anything else we want to say in that paragraph first before we go on? What it was saying up front. Again, just the whole point of this, these individuals and this institution that fosters them. Social leadership is transformed by spiritual insight. Right? Imagine if you had a social leader, the starting point was spiritual insight instead of social cleverness. Right? That would be such a different thing. Religion prevents all collective movements from losing sight of their true objectives. Like I said, you can't get to true if you don't first have real. Right? You can't have a sphere predicated on eternity if you don't have the center point predicated on eternity. Right? So, religion is going to see to it that there's reality so that when you engage the whole picture, the sphere of truth, right, it can be just that and can be maintained as that. These can be true. The group can have true objectives, which are effective, lasting, objectives. Instead of work, 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 and then the second you let go of it, it all just evaporates. You know, what's the point? Right? Wouldn't it be wonderful if you constructed something and the local universe, creative Mother Spirit, upheld it? Instead of just shrugging her shoulders at your efforts? If you make something cosmic, she'll uphold it. If you make something, you know, like you, like the animal you, not so much, right? Right? There's been a lot of animal individuals that have gone extinct. Right? Think about during the Permian extinction, how many species she didn't uphold. Right? They were very fancy in and of themselves. Right? In the blink of an eye, they all just disappeared. Right? If we want our efforts to be enduring, right, they have to be different than what animals do. Right. All right.
True religion is a meaningful way of living dynamically, face to face with the commonplace realities of everyday life. But if religion is to stimulate individual development of character and augment integration of personality, it must not be standardized. If it is to stimulate evaluation of experience and serve as a value lure, it must not be stereotyped. If religion is to promote supreme loyalties, it must not be formalized.
In other words, it has to be fundamentally individual, and hence personal, and hence absolutely unique in each individual. The moment that you standardize, stereotype, or formalize, it can't be personal, right? Because there's no overlap in personalities for as a basis for standardization or, you know, formalization or whatever, right? And you can see this whole bit about this religious institution is going to stimulate individual development of character and augment integration of personality. It's not going to improve, you know, the hunger problem or something.
See? Not directly.
See? It's an inner life dedicated group. Individual development of character, right, and augment and integration of personality. See, it's going to be fostering your personality, encompassing a triunity nature inside, encompassing that cosmic nature that is now reflectively within you. That's the goal of that religious effort, like I was saying.
Did somebody say must 3 times?
Yeah, must, right. We say it just endlessly here, right?
Well, Jesus talks, I mean, where he gives a talk on true religion and religion, he talks about, you know, the religion of the mind versus the religion of the spirit. And he does say, you know, God's not belittling even the very primitive religionist, but there's the debate, he points out the difference between this is more religion of the mind, so to speak, going to church every Sunday and that kind of thing, and now you accomplish your religion versus the religion of the spirit of what's really, you know, as you say, you're taking a different perspective from it. You're trying to look at it from, you keep using the phrase top down, mm-hmm. but really when you try to do that, it definitely makes a difference. It takes a while, but I think it's it opens up the whole concept of what religion is. And
see, I mean, like development of character. How does character develop? I mean, character is a word that describes a state of your mind. Okay, well, so you're talking about some sort of improvement in the state of your mind. Does matter dominate mind? No. Spirit dominates mind. I mean, the only way that you're going to set up a different character in your mind, the only way you can reframe and direct and sustain an improved state of mind is top down, right? It has to be a religion of the spirit. You have to start with spirit substance, right? And apply it down, top down, onto your mind, supplying that favorable condition for the mind to be grown into a greater character. And you know, that's, see, again, the moment that you go from religion of matter to religion of mind to religion of spirit, right? And once you get all the way to that other endpoint, you've gone from something that's purely external, religion of matter, to something that's purely internal, right? Religion of the mind is 50-50, sort of, right? It's, you know, six of one, half dozen of another. Right?
Matter's like the old days when they worshipped the rocks and the things like that.
Right, religion of matter, and it starts totally external, right, yeah. Or the rock or the hill or the sun or whatever.
Cow.
Right, yeah.
Right?
You know, and you know, so it's you first you got to start bringing it into your mind, but then you've got to get up to the top of your mind, you know, and start anew with spirit. And see, the whole point is, see, I mean, obviously, once you get to the totally other end, then the whole concept of what religion is for is going to be turned on its head. It's going to be 180 degrees different. And it's all going to be about what, you know, a personal direction of spirit can do for your mind, not what your mind can do for matter. See, again, what your mind can do for matter, that's service. But what can the spirit do for the mind? And if there needs to be a group that's dedicated to what spirit can do for the mind. And then we'll get to what mind can do for matter, service. All right. And again, just notice when they say true religion is a meaningful way of living dynamically face to face with the commonplace realities of everyday life. Okay, they're talking about all this outer life stuff. That's why they didn't say real religion. They said true religion, because you've gone beyond just, right, that sort of just that absolute, you know, nucleus of you related to eternity, to bringing in the whole picture, reaching out to the whole picture. So that real religion in a universal holistic context. Now it's true religion. Now it goes beyond you as the individual. It can go into the commonplace realities of everyday life, for instance. Or it can go to your neighbor.
And true religion is... An indispensable, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the four indispensables for advancing civilization, true religion, true monogamy, prayer, God consciousness, yeah. It's the first one, true religion. And that's what, see, again, that's what we're talking about. See, if you're going to go, you know, beyond what happens naturally, the early phase of progressing civilization, if you're going to get into that advancing phase, you've got to bring in this originality that goes beyond what's there by grace with the encirclement and the Holy Spirit. You've got to start with true religion, like they're trying to get us to recognize here. That's the predicate for everything going forward from there. All right, let's see. Anything else? You know, just, you know, again, you know, notice those things about, you know, beyond the one about development of caring, integration of personality. Say, you also have stimulate evaluation of experience. See, value, right? Evaluation, right? Starting with values, starting with spirit substance, and considering things, you know, against that backdrop, you know, against that background, you know, value lure, supreme loyalty. See, all these things that are about the heights of your inner life as a new starting point. Instead of just starting with thing, start with value on the opposite end.
So when it says it must not be formal, it doesn't mean that my supreme loyalty may not be the same as his or his. That's got it. It just means that it's not just a formal reading out of the book every day and going home. So is that what that?
Right. So yeah. I mean, this religious group, this institutionalized religion, this new institutionalized religion, has to remember that it's trying to foster individuals first, which are unique. It can't do that with one-size-fits-all sort of stimulus. Right? So again, it's kind of puzzling to figure out. It's like, well, how exactly does this work? What does a group do except something that's been formalized? You know, I mean, we just think in terms of ritual. We just can't really think any other way, right? So, how do you create something that isn't static like that? How do you create something that's living, dynamic, like they're saying? How do you stimulate that? The point is not to answer all these questions right now. If the point was to answer those questions right now, there would be a paragraph in the book that laid it all out. Okay, the whole point is to just challenge us to begin the process of seeking this different approach to ourselves. How can we stimulate one another in this living dynamic way instead of the much more static way that we've tried to stimulate everyone, you know, in the past? So let's come up with a creed and let's all say it together, you know, or let's, you know, come up with a party plank, you know, and everyone, you know, sign to it or whatever. I mean, all of these, like they're saying, standardized, stereotyped, formalized things that we always do with ourselves. How can we be less static like that? All right, and here's this next paragraph, gets to what John was, when John was reading from up there, and end of paper two, right? You see in this next paragraph here.
No matter what upheavals may attend the social and economic growth of civilization, religion is genuine and worthwhile if it fosters in the individual an experience in which the sovereignty of truth, beauty, and goodness prevails. For such is the true spiritual concept of supreme reality. And through love and worship, this becomes meaningful as fellowship with man and sonship with God.
Okay, so there is the truth, beauty, goodness again. Remember, and that's the eternity triplet. And so it's religion's job to deal with that eternity triplet. Beauty being one, and, you know, and the truth there is that truths of existential eternity, and the goodness is perfectness. So, be you perfect, even as Father is perfect. See, that's you know, fostering that goodness part, the perfectness, awareness of that, taking a hold of that, and never letting go of that as a foundational predicate. As they're saying, no matter what upheavals may attend the social and economic growth of civilization. Okay, how can you not be part of such upheavals? You will be part of them if you're standing with them in time. If your feet are planted in time, you can't help but be part of the upheavals. See, but they're saying the religious group is trying to foster someone who's standing on eternity. So that no matter what happens, right, their hands are free to engage all of the complexities of the vicissitudes of the upheavals. And their feet just stand unmoved in the midst of that. So the job of the religious group is to, as they said there, see, fosters in the individual. not in that collective. Let's form a religious group that prevents upheavals. See, that's not the job of a religious group. No, the religious group is to make individuals who are immune to upheavals because they don't stand on that which is upheavable. They stand on eternity, which is changeless.
What does it matter to a true son of God if the whole world crashes?
Right. And so,
because you're not standing on it.
Yeah, what does it matter to a son of God? And you go, oh, I'm constantly all caught up. Oh, I'm not starting with my son of God nature, am I? See, it's a little challenge to remind you, right? If you are genuinely God-knowing, nothing that happens in the material domain, death or relatives or anything, causes any issue. And so when you read that in the book, you're going, oh, so in other words, what they're saying is I'm not God-knowing, really, and I don't know anyone who is. Right? I know people who are God-grasping. Okay? But do I know anyone who's immune? Whoa. What would it be like if you had a whole planet of people like that? What kind of a society would they have? Right. Unimaginable.
Chris, I don't think it's black and white like that, though, because it's a process all through the mansion worlds, too, where it's not always that you're on right on the money like that. So it doesn't mean you have to think that you're never
Of course. But,
so it's not black and white.
But it's just,
not a dichotomy, as you always say.
But just remembering that what you're heading towards, is such a state.
Like, how long from now?
Right. I mean, until you are inconcussable, you can't fuse with your thought adjuster.
Right. Like, that's one
landmark. See, once I fuse with my thought adjuster, that means I'm never going to, ever again, after I fuse with my adjuster, never will I be, knocked off my moorings.
Right.
Right?
But still, it doesn't mean that we're not experiencing
again, all I'm pointing out is when there's sentences in the book that say God knowing in this absolute sort of a way, and you're going, oh yeah, okay, they didn't qualify there, but see what they're referring to is getting to that state where you're not just occasionally God knowing and maturing into being more and more so. But you're just God-knowing, period.
Terry, it doesn't mean that, like they say, the will of God can be done in any practice. Some are secular and some are religious. It doesn't mean you can't, you don't have to live your life here and experience it like we're stuck here. But just it's more the perspective you have, the more the attitude you have, the more you can understand that where you're really coming from. So that it doesn't, overtake you, overwhelm you, so to speak. You still have to live it. You still have to go through it. I mean, we got probably billions of years of living life, through all this different experience, learning and so on and so forth. I think what you were saying is if your focus is that, be perfect, which is your focus forever, mm-hmm. Even as I am perfect in the way you can, mm-hmm. then, one thing I found from reading a revelation like this, you wish that everybody, you give them a chip and just go right in there, because it really totally changes your perspective on being able to have this, as you were mentioning, Chris, this really, this feeling of, security and uncertainty amongst all the uncertainty and insecurity. You just know that, you're not, as you said a minute ago, somebody else is totally in control.
Mm-hmm.
And, to align yourself to that is,
that's the
experience. How do you?
Right, and again, it's the revelation is a challenge. Okay, it's not a fault finding text. It's not listing all the ways that you fall short. Okay, that's not the point. But it is trying to get you to not be satisfied with the lesser. Right? Don't be satisfied until you're completely immune. Don't be satisfied. It's like, you know, one day, 5 years ago, I was immune, you know, to of difficulty. Don't be satisfied with that. Don't be satisfied until you are 100% immune. I mean, it says, God knowing individuals are not discouraged by misfortune or downcast by disappointment. Okay, it doesn't say God knowing individuals are seldom discouraged. See? It's just a period statement, right? Or not. Believers are immune to the depression consequent upon purely material upheavals, like your spouse dying. Okay? They're immune. Right? Spirit livers are not perturbed by the episodes of the material world.
But their kidneys are.
Sorry. You know, so you see how unqualified it is. And see, and the whole point is to be able to read something like that and not be filled with yes, but it's just to take on that challenge. I am not going to be satisfied until those sentences describe me.
Where is that?
It's in paper 156, okay. Great big long section, section 5. Jesus is teaching at Tyre. Right? You know, just to be able to just courageously, see, face that challenge. I'm going to be like that because that's what it means to be godlike. Right? God never is, downcast by disappointment, you know, depressed, you know, perturbed, right? But, you know, you can give lip service to being godlike, but okay, have you really thought about what that means?
It's the idea that for force we must serve two masters. If you think about profit motive and service motive, two people can be doing the same thing, one out of profit motive and the other out of service motive. The only difference between them is in the inner life of the individual himself. So the only way to truly do something from service motive is with God knowingness.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's not really service, not truly service motive.
Right. The word motive is an inner life word.
Yeah.
And, that contrast between profit motive and service motive, as you're pointing out, okay, they use the word motive in both cases, so it's both inner life. But with profit motive, the inner life that you're starting with that establishes the motive is an inner life that's been constructed by taking the external world and lifting it up and in, right? Exalting it into a motive, material affairs. Right? Service motive doesn't have that issue where you've drug something in and up and falsely exalted it. It starts with the cosmos, you know, and your personal realization of divine fellowship. It starts with love, right, and goes down and out. Right? It's so, you know, one is a cosmically established motive, and the other is a human constructed motive. Right, the profit motive is a motive of human construct. Right, we've pulled something in and up, right, and made that the spiritual predicate. Okay, and it's a natural thing to do, so it's what needs to happen in the early stages. Right, when humans are primitive, they can't do this top-down thing. The only thing they can do is take something, you know, in and up, you know. And as time goes by, they take better and better things from the outside in and up, you know, and civilization progresses as they do that. But eventually, you've taken the highest thing out there in and up. And so there, no more progression is possible. The only way to progress past that point is to bring something original down.
Go to the God in the sky.
Right. It's just, you can only go so far by going to higher and higher, you know, levels of outside, higher quality outside, and exalting it, you know, as the voice of conscience, you know, within you. Right? That, so again, see, it's right back to what we're talking about here. That's what this is all about, is setting up a situation where you can actually move into the second phase of the progress of civilization.
Yeah. You know, that gives a lot of help with understanding what this looks like in time. It's not being of time, but you're in time.
Mm-hmm.
So that you have a, well, last year I used to be upset about that. I'm not now.
Mm-hmm.
You can be fortified by that. Don't be satisfied. Yeah. But you can be fortified.
Yeah.
You can be fortified by the statements like, even if I can't, there's one within me who can and will, you know.
Yes. Yeah. Find contentment in the successes you've had so far, but do not, you know, take it to satisfaction and short circuit your progress. You got to stay ever hungry, right? Never be satisfied, right? You know, until you are perfect, even as the Father in heaven is perfect, okay? And then you're allowed a temporary moment of satisfaction, right? And then they blow the doors off and you start all over again, right? Right. But
maybe you're not satisfied, but you can feel safe, or you can feel okay.
That's contentment. That's, you know, see, that you're content
because, right? Right.
You're comfortable. There it is. You know you're moving forward. You know you're not at the end. You're moving forward. You. There's some things in the rearview mirror, right?
You know,
it isn't like when you started where you look in the rearview mirror and there was just a wall there, right? Let's see. What else do we have there? So that, again, see that whole bit about, it fosters in the individual an experience in which the sovereignty of truth, beauty, and goodness prevails. It just, see, so you know that no matter what happens out there, no matter what problems of sovereignty are out there, or apparent problems of sovereignty are out there, right? In the inner domain, you have a hold of truth, beauty, and goodness where you're sovereign, and that's the character of that sovereignty. It's described as a domain of truth, beauty, and goodness. And no matter what, that's your predicate. You'll approach those upheavals with that starting point. Right? With that threefoldness foothold in eternity. All right.
After all, it is what one believes rather than what one knows that determines conduct and dominates personal performances. Purely factual knowledge exerts very little influence upon the average man unless it becomes emotionally activated. But the activation of religion is super emotional, unifying the entire human experience on transcendent levels through contact with and release of spiritual energies in the mortal life.
Okay, so this paragraph starts out, you know, it's reminding of what, how this works naturally, how kind of anything gets off the starting block. You know, if you didn't have emotions, you know, everything would just be stuck in its starting point blob state. Right? So that's one of the reasons why we have emotions, is to get the primitive human moving. Right? You will obey something if you've emotionalized it, right? So like they're saying there, right? It's just, you know, the pure facts, you don't do much. They just sit there, right? But if you have some emotional energization about it, okay, now people are doing stuff. So that's how things get moving and keep moving in the early half, right, of the progress of civilization. You know, it's what one believes rather than what one knows that determines conduct and dominates personal performances. They're saying, okay, now, but it's now a time to move beyond that and to go above emotions. See, super emotional. The activation of religion is above emotions. So, what fundamentally is this activation, you know, that leads to you obeying, right? And you should be kind of knowing where I'm going now. You hear me say it all the time. You know, as you start to think about what's the difference between truth and fact, you can't obey facts. That's what they're saying here. But you can obey truth. Right? And it has the same drive as when primitives obey emotionalized facts, only it's even more dynamic and takes you ever further than you ever imagined. Right? That's what that, see, and like I was saying, the activation of religion, you get that nucleus, and then you can have true religion, you can have that sphere of truth extending out from that real religious nucleus that engages the rest of life and everyone else, all other things and beings. And that fundamentally dynamic fact of truth, when everyone is following that dynamic fact, everyone is moving.
Why do the heathen rage?
Okay. Facts just sit there, right? Right. Right, so yeah, because you obey not the truth. He knows the line, right? Right? Why do you languish in futile yearning? Because you obey not the truth. Right? In the same way that the heathen, you know, whip themselves up emotionally, you know, and conquer cities. Right? Right? If you're a Zulu, you know, you whip yourself up emotionally. Right, and off you go, almost unstoppable. That's what they're getting at. So when you go above emotions, your thought is like, well, what's going to drive things then? There's a dynamic fact up there, truth, that instead of having emotions driving you, you just strike step with the truth and the motion is innately there. You don't have to drive yourself anymore. You just go with the flow of truth, and you courageously let it take you wherever it will. Right? You strike step with the dynamic flow of the cosmos. Right? And that's what moves civilization forward in those advancing ages. But it all has to, you have to have a real religious nucleus in the individual first.
And then you get into the quid est veritas thing.
Right. See, and that's, again, why did Pontius Pilate say quid est veritas, right? And why is that still in the dictionary? Because why this section is here. We don't know this real religious starting point yet. And hence we don't know truth. Once you have the real religious nucleus, no one asks what is truth. It's self-evident. It's the dynamic thing that you find yourself in the midst of. It's not a mystery anymore. But when you're not in the midst of it, it's, yeah, you're clueless. It's like, you know, I'm looking around. I don't see anything dynamic. It all looks like pretty static to me.
People remember what Pilate said. But who remembers what Jesus said that prompted Pilate's response?
Yeah.
What did he say? Do you remember? Pilate asked him what his purpose was.
Yeah.
He said, my purpose is to reveal truth. Simply. That's
right.
What he said.
Right. See, and that's just what I was just saying. See, you know, he said, if you find that religious nucleus, truth will be revealed to you. It's just there. You're in the midst of this dynamic fact that you hitherto were ignorant of. Right? It's revealed to you. Right? And right, so that's what they're getting at there. It's obeying the truth. And you know, and I'll say it again. I mean, you say what you want about Pilate, but God blessed him. I mean, him saying that, and like you're saying, for it to really shine more brightly 2,000 years later than what you know prompted Pilate to say that from Jesus. Pilate contributed greatly, right? To have that question out there, yeah, what is truth, right? And you know you can't just answer that question by saying, well, there is no such thing, so it's a meaningless question. It's like, no, you know there is something. Right? And we, just the fact that we don't know what it is doesn't mean it doesn't exist. We know it exists, and we should be truth seekers. We should be you know, not be satisfied until we are there in the midst of that self-evident dynamic phenomenon that we can strike step with.
This is really fun how they give you something you're really familiar with. Everybody's familiar with emotion.
Yeah.
Everybody knows what it's like to be motivated by emotion.
Yeah.
And it's potent, right?
Yeah.
It's the most potent thing you can relate to.
Yeah.
Before they introduce you to the super emotion idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's not going to be vague.
Yeah.
There's nothing vague about what they're describing here.
Yeah, and not only that, but because we all know emotion so intimately, can you actually see the word super emotional and interpret it properly? Or do you hear hyper emotional?
Yeah, you do hear ADHD.
No.
Things you need to be medicated.
Not hyper emotional. Not more horizontally extreme. No, above emotions. Right? In the Urantia book, super is literal. It's above. Right? Okay, so that's what that paragraph is about. And obviously, like they're saying, it's just you know, once that's there's such an innate internal dynamo in every individual, the fruits of the Spirit, see, that flow out are just so richly living now. Without you, you know, doing anything except just being a means for the dynamic nature of truth to flow out into the world, right? You don't have to build anything. There's no self-help book that you've got to read. It just happens.
Moving past that epistolar conflict into faith, determination, love, loyalty, progress.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
During the psychologically unsettled times of the 20th century, amid the economic upheavals, the moral cross currents, and the sociologic riptides of the cyclonic transitions of a scientific era, thousands upon thousands of men and women have become humanly dislocated. They are anxious, restless, fearful, uncertain, and unsettled. As never before in the world's history, they need the consolation and stabilization of sound religion. In the face of unprecedented scientific achievement and mechanical development, there is spiritual stagnation and philosophic chaos.
Okay, I mean, you hear me say it all the time. You know, pretty darn close to just saying it point blank there at the end of that paragraph. The endarkenment. Right? Spiritual stagnation and philosophic chaos. Quote unquote, the endarkenment. That's what that endarkenment means. The opposite of the Enlightenment. you know, you need spiritual vitality and, you know, philosophic progress. But we don't have it.
I wonder why they don't say millions upon millions instead of thousands upon
thousands. I'm going to get to that.
Oh, you are?
That's a very important thing to know. Or why doesn't it say billions upon billions? Yeah. All right. A little millions upon millions. Okay. So again, like I always say, you move into the 20th century and you move into the Enlightenment, right? During the psychologically unsettled times of the 20th century. Okay, that's what they're talking about. You've got all these upheavals, cross currents, riptides, etc., like they're saying there. And they say thousands upon thousands of men and women have become humanly dislocated. Okay, what does humanly dislocated mean? In other words, they're knocked off their human moorings. Right? They don't have that by grace predicate in eternity and hence stability, right, that we're all given as any sort of a active force in their life. Right? If you're not humanly located, where are you located, animal? Right? And you're going, oh, so everyone is basically in an animal state, but it doesn't say billions upon billions. It says just thousands upon thousands. Yeah, well, it's sad to record that so few persons were humanly located to begin with so that they could be dislocated.
Oh. We're talking about the vanguard here.
All right. Again, all we've been reading was talking about, we've got this whole, you know, early phase of the progress of civilization, which basically just happens in spite of the fact that we're mostly just fancy animals. Okay? And it's all kind of predicated on this super conscious human by grace nature, right? And we are drug along. Okay. Yeah, but you get into the Renaissance, the three centuries of being born again, literally, right? And human nature is beginning to awaken, and you move into the Enlightenment, and you start to see the fruits of that start to pour forth. But then it reaches its peak and starts to fizzle, and those the core group of people that were seeding civilization with their human location, they get knocked off their moorings, and all of the fancy animals no longer are benefiting from that, and the whole thing just, you know, drifts down into oblivion. Like they say, you know, as never before in the world's history. So again, like I was saying up front, what we need now is not just what we had then. Again. Okay? Sure, we've gone so far into the dark, but we have to at least get back to where we were then. But what we really need is not merely that. We need something that has never been the possession of mankind, as never before in the world's history. We need individuals with conscious, cosmic consciousness, not unconscious cosmic consciousness. Right, not just up there super consciously, and you're just an unwitting benefactor, right, of its presence there. We need this as a conscious possession. You start with that triune nature predicated on eternity with truth, beauty, and goodness, and then you move it into time and space with the fact, truth, goodness triplet. All that stuff we talk about so much, right? We need that, and again, remember what we're focusing on, sort of immediately here, is not the full philosophic flower, Okay, but the starting point, the real religious nucleus, right? The consolation and stabilization of sound religion. Okay, we need to get ourselves grounded again in eternity so we can stabilize the situation. And you know, and you will get back sort of the philosophic quality that's sort of around that by grace religious nucleus once you relocalize on it, right? Recenter on it. But then, you know, build from there. Do what they didn't do at the beginning of the 20th century. You know, they sort of reached the heights of what you can do unwittingly, and then they stopped, and hence everything fell back down again. Take it up consciously and continue up from there. That's what we need to do. All right. Yeah, so that's why it says thousands upon thousands, just reminding you, there's so few persons.
So this progression they just are treating here, it sounds a lot like the fourth, fifth, and sixth adjutant kind of parallels.
I mean,
how this weaves together with the advent of the seventh and the collective.
Mm-hmm. And again, see, I mean, like I was saying, you were on a upward path. The problem is to complete the process, it has to become a conscious, you know, choice-driven phenomenon. You can't just progress the rest of the way in spite of yourself. All right? You top out, you know, and then everything falls back again. So, you know, we can drift forward in time to the point where you'd think, well, I think probably now would be when the seventh adjutant would dawn in the collective, but it's not going to happen because there's no receivers. Right. They can transmit all, you know, the adjutants can transmit a collective mode all they want. If there's no receivers, nothing happens.
It has to be seated up.
Right. See, and that's the thing. You know, it can be rather unconscious that you're receivers early on, but when you move from the animal adjutants, you know, 4 and 5, you know, beyond that, okay, now it's got to be more of a conscious phenomenon. Yeah, and the sixth in the middle of the 20th century, see, that's really not fully human yet. That's just semi-human. Right? That's half of the two adjutants that make you human, you know, in contrast to the five for the animals. Yeah. See, and so you can't really get to the seventh unless the receivers have chosen their receiverness.
Mm-hmm. What are receivers?
Yeah, the human minds being able... being chosen to be a receiver of this additional ministry, mind ministry, you have to choose the favorable conditions for it. Right? That's what I mean by being a receiver. Right? The favorable conditions, the predicate, the prerequisites, whatever word you want to use. It isn't sort of just there by grace. It needs to be more consciously chosen. So again, that's what this is all about. That's why you want to think about real religion. All right, let's keep going here.
There is no danger in religions becoming more and more of a private matter, a personal experience, provided it does not lose its motivation for unselfish and loving social service. Religion has suffered from many secondary influences. Sudden mixing of cultures, intermingling of creeds, diminution of ecclesiastical authority, changing of family life, together with urbanization and mechanization.
Okay, so this is going to kind of address, we won't get very far because, you know, it's the next section that gets into the social aspects of religion, as you can see. But you can see they're starting to hint at this. We've gone around with it some already tonight. It's like, well, what about the service part? We're going to get there, just not tonight. Notice that there won't be any danger of you overplaying the individuality of real religion. You know, that's what they're saying there, right? kind of getting too fixated on the absolute dimension of your personality, which is absolutely separate from in relationship to anything else and all that, becoming such an island universe, you won't be in any danger of that if you remind yourself of what they said earlier on, which was in the first paragraph we read tonight. It wasn't just divine religion. Remember, there was two things. Human friendship was the other one. Right? There'll be no danger if at the same time that you sort of discover yourself as a personality, you also discover what's innately there with that fact, other personalities. Okay? The cure to this potential problem, it's nothing that needs to be added. It's already there. You just have to not close your eyes to it. Okay? As soon as you get up to the religious level, so you get to that spiritual level, that sort of full activation of your personality, other personalities are automatically there at that level too. But there's none so blind as those who will not see. And you can will not see them, okay, if you choose. So just don't do that, right? Don't go up there so fixated on yourself that you cut yourself off. Because if you get all the way up there, you now have the greatest energies available to you. And in isolation, you can do the greatest damage to yourself now. That's the danger thing that you're talking about there. Okay? So, to him who much is given is much expected. Okay? If you're going to play with the big guns up there, okay, you need to make sure that you don't isolate yourself. Right? That's what Lucifer did. Right? You start to isolate yourself, and all this potentially great stuff becomes very problematic. Right? It becomes self-destroying stuff. Right? And the way to prevent that is just make sure that you're finding those love-based others as in the same at the same time that you find the love-based you. And you think of yourself top down and you find them top down, right? Being connected. Why did Jesus take them down off the Mount of Transfiguration, right? Because he knew this very problem, this danger. Right? You get them inspired to find the heights within themselves. You got to make sure that there's immediately an interplay with others so that this doesn't become a self-destructive achievement. Okay? So that's what they're getting at there.
God kind of did that, didn't he?
Yes.
No.
Yes.
What'd you say?
God did exactly that. Right. He made others.
I thought a way to do that is to remember a couple things. One is your personality is a gift from God. Your faith is a gift from God. Your mind is a gift from God. Pretty much everything excepting your will to choose is really, from God. It's a gift from God. So, in effect, all of you is pretty much God-like to start out with. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is get in touch with it.
Use it that way and not abuse it that way.
Right, well.
Exactly. Yeah.
But
right.
So it's everybody else, too. So it's not like you're here alone. I mean, imagine, God has split himself into infinite parts in just the adjusters. Think about that. And then, not even think about that, think about personality. All the infinite parts, which a lot of people who have personality don't have adjusters. It's like, wow. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's very hard to fathom, but...
And to think of it in terms of, it's like, well, if I get up there, I'm not alone, right? There's God knowing this up there. I mean, I not only find myself, I find the other. Why isn't the other adequate to keep me from going astray? Why do I need others? isn't the other adequate? No, because the other is like no other. The other is purely existential. Okay? And you need experiential, interplay with experiential others. You can't get that with him. If you were a purely existential being, okay, he would be adequate. But you're not. You're an experiential being with a tiny little existential predicate, right? That's there by grace. You need experiential others. If you cut yourself off from experiential others, it actually will produce this introspective self-destroying phenomenon. Right? I mean, you don't sort of you can't have an experiential interplay with him, right? You're just in existential relationship to him. See, and if you don't have that experiential interplay that keeps you rolled out, right? You just wrap back on yourself, and initially you're orbiting about him, yeah, inside there. But the more times you go around, the more, right, you decide you're orbiting about yourself. It all goes very bad, just like it did with Lucifer.
Okay? And Judas.
And whoever, right. Anyone that just isolates and starts orbiting inside like that, see? Yeah. Fortunately for Judas, he had this great gift given to him by God called death to short circuit that. Lucifer wasn't given that gift. He starts in that inside orbit thing, okay, and it goes on forever, right, until he ceases to be a personality, and the divine executioners recycle the parts, okay. The wonderful technique of death, helps us. We can only, get into that mode for so long, and death intervenes and short circuits it for us. Thank God. Right. I mean,
kind of reminiscent of a really powerful engine. And if you hit the pedal and you don't tie it to a transmission, the engine's going to destroy itself.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole thing about love is, love is not something you get by getting it. It's a paradox. You really only get it by giving it. So if you haven't got anybody, it seems to me that by giving it, especially with people who you can see and touch and so on, is a start to be able to.
That's another way of sort of thinking about why this needs to roll out, to others. I mean, because the whole point is to be encircuited. Right. The love comes in, to you and goes out and back, and it completes a circuit. Right. But the moment that you don't have God, it's going to orbit inside of you. It's going to become self-love. The love doesn't go away. it'll turn internal as self-love.
Humble. Yeah. Needs a load. Put a load on it. Output, load.
Let's see. I think we... let's keep going.
Man's greatest spiritual jeopardy consists in partial progress, the predicament of unfinished growth, forsaking the evolutionary religions of fear without immediately grasping the revelatory religion of love. Modern science, particularly psychology, has weakened only those religions which are so largely dependent upon fear, superstition, and emotion.
Right. As soon as you get a budding science of psychology, and you start to really think about how the mind works, even if you're in a state like we are now, where we're kind of confused about brain and mind and stuff, whatever. But you begin to recognize how you've got all of this internal fear, superstition, emotion stuff, and that. This has nothing to do with some so-called spirit world or anything, like humans have thought for the last million years. And so the whole notion of the ghost cult religion is blown up. by the science of psychology, even in its budding primitive stage that it's in right now. I mean, that religion is so primitive, it takes, you know, it only takes a primitive psychology to blow it up.
Yeah, this is the transition difficulty.
Right. Right. So, yeah, and another way where there, you have this transition, because at the same time, see that you get to the point where you can, you could make this transition to a religion of love instead of a religion of fear. Like they're saying there, you've spun up science. Okay, and you know, that initial science seems to say there is no such thing as religion. Okay, and right, and so see, you've got this catch-22 sort of here, you know, that's set up. I mean, you need that budding science to be able to take this next step, but that budding science convinces you that there is no next step. And as a matter of fact, the supposed steps you made before with the religion weren't real in the first place, and so everything just collapses then, like what happened. Right? The Enlightenment produced the Endarkenment, you can say, see? Because it was an Enlightenment amongst an immature people. all right, so it's you know, you obviously normally have the external cosmic, you know, helpers here, you know, to help mankind through this stuff. But when we've got to do it all ourselves, I mean, you've got all of these transition points where everything can collapse, and of course, kind of just does, because, you know, they aren't out there to hold us up during the transition stage. And transition stages are always difficult. Remember, the whole universe is kind of holding their breath when, as Jesus is maturing and he gets into his developmental transition stage. It's like, because they all know it doesn't matter if he's an incarnate Son of God, he's true man. And you can fall into the chasm, right, between the two sides during that transition phase. So remember, it talks about the whole universe is kind of holding their breath, you know. It's like, is he going to make it? Is he going to make this transition, right? Where, you know, you start predicated on time and you got to flip it around to being predicated on eternity. Yeah. Right? And does it just all fall through the cracks during that transition? Unfortunately, he had the family and society and whatnot. I mean, the rigorous completed religious life of the Jews was very helpful to that, to kind of hold him together while he's making that transition, right? Sure, in and of itself, it's very rote and ritualistic and, you know, limited, but, right, it held him together, helped to hold him together along with his family while he made that transition, right? If you don't have family or some, you know, solid religious structure, are you going to make the transition as an individual? Not likely. Right? You're probably going to have a time in your life when you fall into the hole. And you're going to spend decades trying to claw your way up out of that pit that you fell into as you tried to make that transition. And it doesn't happen automatically. You need help during that transition time.
Is there some kind of... local universe precedent for that phenomena of a creator son's bestowal career, where, you know, it's founded on something happening like that? Or,
well, I mean, obviously, you know, they have contingency plans for everything. Remember, you know, there's even contingency plans if a creator son went into rebellion, right? Even though it's, you know, it's not going to happen, right? But, you know, it's theoretically possible, even if it isn't going to actually happen. You know, again, there's a reason why Gabriel selected wisely where, you know, and with whom. And, right, I mean, because, you know, he can't just plop, you know, the incarnation in anywhere and expect, for instance, the maturing Son of Man to make this transition. He needs to make sure that the structure is there, you know, so that that child can make that transition. Okay. Speaking about transitions. Let's see. Anything else we need to say there before we go on and wrap things up here? I think we got everything there. We've said it all. So read, you know, the preface and all the 3 points as well.
Transition is always accompanied by confusion, and there will be little tranquility in the religious world until the great struggle between the three contending philosophies of religion is ended. 1, the spiritistic belief in a providential deity of many religions. 2, the humanistic and idealistic belief of many philosophies. 3, the mechanistic and naturalistic conceptions of many sciences.
Okay, so this passage is always confusing because it's so sparse in a way, right? You've got to reflect on it and sort of add the additional clarity, right, that is not pedantically laid out for you. What they're getting at here is, when they say three contending philosophies of religion, so, you know, the word religion there, you know, think of it in kind of this evolutionary sense as this phenomenon that's full of potential. There's great hope for it to be ever advancing and improving. And that religious element, you know, always needs some context it exists within. Some basic worldview that is, you know, is the all-encompassing context predicate that it exists within. Okay, and the point of the three, you know, the three items there, the enumerated list there, is how do you come up with this kind of basic worldview context that you think of religion as being within? Okay, and each of those, okay, the final words, you know, are religions, philosophies, sciences on each of those three lists. Okay, so to help you, put those three words in quotes, right? Of many quote-unquote religions, of many quote-unquote philosophies, of many quote-unquote sciences, right? And so what has passed for religion, philosophy, science historically, okay? There's three different ways that humans have or are coming up with a basic worldview set of assumptions, context, that you're going, you know, if you want to be bring religion into that's what you think is the predicate, right? The worldview that you're trying to put religion into. Okay, so is it number one? Is it that spiritistic belief? Okay, so think the ghost cult, you know, concept, where there's this notion that you call spirit. You know, there's spirit land, and it's in some way co-present with material land, matter land, that you're immediately aware of, and it's an intimate, interactive interplay, right? Spirit land pushes on matter land, and matter land pushes on spirit land, right? I mean, that whole in a providential deity, right? I mean, that whole primitive providence idea, you know, that you've got this, you have this grand material influence right? That's behind and amidst everything. Right? And the Lord works in mysterious ways through this providential material influence. Okay, right? So is that your, you know, is that your basic worldview, that you think that's fundamentally the world you live in, a world that is really kind of ruled by spirit land, and we in matter land are subject to it, right, for good or for ill, and you see religion in that worldview context? Okay, that's one option. Or number two, do you start with, you know, not what you call quote unquote spirit, but what is more mind and self? Okay, so humanistic and idealistic. Okay, so in other words, the humans are the source, human minds are the source, you know, idealism in that you know, traditional, quote-unquote, philosophic way of, you know, by idealism, you mean mind, human minds, and basically all there is mind. You know, so is that your worldview, right? So you don't have this fanciful, externalized notion of this providential spirit world, you know, influence thing, right? You think that basically what we have is just we're all in kind of this mind space, you know, that's what sets the context. And religion, if we're going to believe in religion, is going to be something that we construct in that predicate, right? It's about having some special, you know, nuclear concept in the midst of human mind doingness. Okay, or is it number three, where you say, okay, it's really, you just have matter. It's what you have. Okay, and yeah, you know, you've got that. You just have that material naturalness, you know, and it's all just a vast mechanism. Okay, and you're going to think of religion as some special aspect within that context. Right, I mean, kind of a simplistic thing is, you know, if you make God just the great watchmaker, for instance, right? And he made the watch and wound it up, and, you know, and it's all just, you know, running its course in a mechanistic sort of a way, you know, or any other variation. There's some new fancy ones, you know. People start with philosophic materialism, which they believe is the proper philosophy now, you know, and you've got modern religionists trying to construct what they call a religion with that starting point, that all there is matter, right? And, you know, and so you have some quote-unquote God, you know, that's some aspect of this vast material process. Okay, that's what that complicated thing is about, obviously it's none of those things. You're not going to get anywhere starting with, you know, I mean, even if you made it real spirit instead of quote-unquote spirit, you can't make a universe out of just spirit energy. You can't make a universe out of just mind energy. You can't make a universe out of just physical energy. Right? It's all three in a triunity, and there's deity on top of it. Right? That's the real universe. Okay, so that's what they basically point out in the final paragraph here.
And these three partial approaches to the reality of the cosmos must eventually become harmonized by the revelatory presentation of religion, philosophy, and cosmology, which portrays the triune existence of spirit, mind, and energy proceeding from the Trinity of Paradise and attaining time-space unification within the deity of the Supreme.
Okay, now we're getting revolutionary here from what you've always thought.
Revolutionary.
Yes, thought religion was. Because now we've taken the quotes off when they say religion, philosophy, and cosmology. Okay, no quotes, right, around them. Not so-called philosophy. Right, and the, spirit, mind, and energy. And look at the rest of that sentence. Okay, we won't go into any depth here, but it's not the universal Father that gives you this context for real religion. It's the Paradise Trinity and the Mother. Okay? See, spirit, mind, and energy, not proceeding from the three persons, but proceeding from the Trinity. Because when you get into deity, there's only one facet of deity that directly engages the totality of reality, that directly engages in lowercase I infinity, right, in its triune nature of spirit, mind, and energy. And that's the Paradise Trinity. That's the only facet of deity that directly engages matter, mind, and spirit. Okay? You know, it's not some sort of spiritistic thing, you know, that you think of as some sort of a ooze from the Father or something. No. Right? The three persons and their deity don't directly engage matter, mind, and spirit. You're going, what?
That's what they say.
Revelatory. Right? Yeah. All right. The fifth epical revelation is revolutionary, you know, in this way. Right. Now, this distinction is vital, for in a cosmic system, the individual members are not connected with each other except in relation to the whole, that's the Paradise Trinity, you know, and through the individuality of the whole, the Mother. When they say attaining time-space unification within the deity of the Supreme, you know, notice it's not, you know, by the deity of the Supreme, but within the deity of the Supreme, right? What's within and what is the unification functioning deity there, that's the Mother deity in the Supreme. For the finite, it's the finite upholder of the Mother. All right, and that's, of course, how you can have true religion. I mean, Universal Father might be, you know, your predicate for real religion, but true religion requires the Paradise Trinity and the Mother to give you the holistic context, right? And so it's a very, very different physics than what's been imagined. It's a very, very different logical context. It's not those so-called logical contexts of one, two, or three. It's something no one's ever even imagined before. Something very different. And a distinct challenge to figure out, you know, what it's about and how you establish a relationship to that context. Okay. But that's, that starts the journey for these five papers on the nature of religion, of ever more bringing in philosophy into the discussion, bringing into that relationship to the whole and the individuality of the whole.
Well, I still don't know what spirit is.
Right.
But I can kind of get the, I kind of have a way to approach it now, because it's only within the context of the whole that we can begin to puzzle out what spirit is.
Yeah. Like I've said before, you got to find the whole, and only then can you find the three parts, spirit, mind, and matter. You think you know what matter is, not really. Because you haven't approached it from the top down yet. You got to find the whole first, and then find matter anew, and at the same time find mind and spirit for the first time.
It says there's going to be a little tranquility until we get there, yeah. And we got a ways to go.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we're gonna be just, you know, flailing about for a long time until, you know, we can achieve this bigger picture. That's why the revelation is here. Yeah. So you got to identify with all of this complexity to get that context. I know maybe all you really want right now is real religion, but you can't get it in some spiritistic context that you're searching for it in. It's like, I'm not in that spirit. Yes, you are. Almost every religionist, anyone who desires to know God and stuff, they're in that number one. And they don't know it. They're in the ghost cult framework, like I talk about all the time. You can't find real religion in the ghost cult framework. It's not there. Okay. So we'll just keep working on this. Like I said, next time we'll get a little bit more into the this, you know, how it goes beyond the individual into a group, you know, the immediacy of a religious group. Okay, let's take a moment here, everyone.